Kuliak, and I'm not sure who we have in Dillingham, but this is Jerry Neer, and we're going to begin, going to be beginning the teleconference here out of Soldotna with the intent of soliciting comments and ideas from the folks that generally don't have access to this effort if it's being conducted in Anchorage and also in Juneau. So I wish you good evening, and who just recently joined me has been Mike Navarre, who has been at a previous meeting. And I guess we will begin this evening by sort of giving a little bit of the background of this state task force, and what our intents are, and what are some of the things that we've accomplished so far, and some of the things that we still wish to address. So I said, Jerry Neer, we'll turn this over to Mike Navarre.
Thank you, Jerry. On behalf of the Health Resources and Access Task Force, I'd like to welcome you to this forum on healthcare reform in Alaska. I'm Mike Navarre, and I'm here with Jerry Neer. We're both members of the task force. Our purpose in holding this forum today is to hear from the public about healthcare in Alaska. We want you to tell us what you like about the current healthcare financing and delivery system in Alaska, as well as what concerns you have about the healthcare insurance and delivery systems in the state. However, before turning the floor over to you for your comments, let me first give you some background on the task force. Let me also take a few moments to share with you some of our findings to date. First, about the task force. It was established by the legislature with the charge of designing a program that would provide access to a basic level of health care services for all Alaskans and to develop a strategy to contain health care costs in the state. The task force began its deliberations in September of last year and is scheduled to present its final recommendations to the governor in the 18th and the 18th legislature on February 1 of 1993. Now let's talk about the issues and problems that the task force has examined over the past year. The issue that is the core of many of the other problems I'll mention in a few moments is the fact that rapidly rising costs are making health care unaffordable for many Alaskans. According to information presented to the task force, from 1979 to 1990, health care spending in the state tripled, increasing from $481 million to over $1.5 billion. In just 6 years, from 1984 to 90, healthcare spending doubled. This rate of growth has far surpassed overall increases in the state's economy and nearly all other industries. While you would think that with all those dollars being spent on healthcare, we'd be able to ensure a basic level of care for all Alaskans. Unfortunately, that just isn't the case. The task force has estimated that there are more than 75,000 Alaskans who don't have any form of private health insurance, are not covered by public programs such as Medicare and Medicaid, and who are not eligible to receive care at an Indian Health Service facility. These uninsured people may well encounter financial barriers to receiving the most basic health care services, may not utilize cost-effective preventive services, and may put off receiving health care until their condition worsens and they need more expensive care to treat it. In addition, when they're required to be hospitalized but are unable to pay for the care, providers are forced to cover the cost of this care by increasing the rates they charge to those who do have insurance or the ability to pay. We have found that most of these uninsured Alaskans are hardworking members of society, just like the rest of us. Over 40% of the uninsured are families in which the head of the household maintains a full-time job throughout the entire year. Another third are families in which a household head works full-time at least part of the year, most likely in some type of seasonal employment. These people are just not lucky enough to work for firms that provide health care coverage. We've also learned that over a quarter of the uninsured are children. The problems caused by spiraling health care costs are not limited solely to the uninsured. In one way or the other, they affect all of us. Those of us with insurance pay higher provider charges to cover the costs of the uninsured. Most of us are also facing increasing copayment and deductible requirements. And many workers who do not receive coverage from their employer are finding that these increasing costs mean that there are fewer dollars available for salary increases. In fact, health care costs are estimated to have doubled between 84 and 90, while total wages and salaries for Alaskan non-agricultural workers increased by only slightly more than 10%. Businesses, too, are adversely affected, as the increased cost of providing coverage for their workers eats into their profit margin. In short, uncontrolled increases in health care costs are good for neither Alaskan businesses nor Alaskan workers. Under our current system, the future doesn't look any brighter. While many of us who do have private health insurance worry about the rising cost of coverage, many are also worried that their insurance will not be for them when they need it. Indeed, the task force is aware that small businesses and their employees may be at risk of having their health care coverage terminated or their premiums increased 100% or more if someone becomes ill. In addition, insured workers or their dependents who have certain medical problems may find that they can no longer get insurance if they change jobs. I should also mention that this concern about our current healthcare financing system is not limited to Alaska. It's a problem that exists nationwide. A recent national survey found that most Americans, including the middle class, were very concerned about the implications of rising healthcare costs. The survey found that over 60% of Americans had significant worries about whether or not they'd be able to afford health insurance. Nearly half were worried that they would not be able to get care because they couldn't afford it, and half were worried that their health care benefits would be cut back substantially. In addition to rising health care costs and concern about insurance coverage, a third important problem has been identified by the task force, namely the availability problems caused by shortages of health care providers in many areas of the state. Regardless of whether or not one has coverages, shortage of key providers and monumental logistical barriers threaten the health and well-being of many Alaskans. The task force recognizes that there are many hardworking, dedicated healthcare providers throughout the state. They are not the problem. The problem is a system, or lack of it, that allows healthcare costs to grow unchecked. A system that leaves tens of thousands of Alaskans without coverage for even the most basic healthcare and leaves them at risk of financial ruin if they should become seriously ill. And a system that leaves major portions of the population without physical access to needed healthcare services. As the task force begins to deliberate over its final recommendations, I should tell you that it's our view at this time that minimal or marginal changes to the way we do business now will not be enough. Simply adding bells and whistles to the current system will not bring healthcare costs under control, nor will it provide universal access for all Alaskans. What we will be exploring are significant and necessary changes that will seek to make healthcare both more affordable and more accessible to all Alaskans. As I said earlier, our purpose in holding these community meetings is to solicit your views and suggestions on healthcare reform in Alaska so that our final recommendations will be as responsive as possible to your needs and concerns. I'll now turn the floor over to you for your comments and observations. If I can, let me try to focus things by putting to you on behalf of the task force two questions. The first is, how has the current healthcare system in Alaska created problems for you? And the second is, what recommendations do you have for reforming the system to make it more responsive to your needs? While I would ask that you keep your comments relatively brief, if you have a particular situation or study you'd like to share in greater detail with the task force, we encourage you to put it in writing and send it to the task force. Our address is shown on the materials you've received. In addition, at the end of the meeting, you'll be asked to fill out a brief questionnaire that hopefully will provide further information for the task force to continue. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Jerry Neer.
Yeah, this is Jerry Neer. Lorna, is Ed Meyer there standing by?
Yes, he is.
Good evening, Ed. It's been a while, I guess, since we visited, but as you guess you're aware, we're still hammering on this issue, and I look forward to your comments, and glad to have you on board working with us this evening. So why don't you go ahead, and we're interested in what you've got to share with us.
Yes, this is Ed Myers. I'm not sure that I have a whole lot to add that has not already been stated, but I think most of the issues that affect most of us in the hospitals have been pretty well articulated. If we look at the issues which confront us greatly, if we talk about health care reform, and I must mention this on behalf of the borough mayor, is that facilities play an awful large part in this too. And it doesn't make any difference if you have good programs and good access, but if you don't have facilities to deliver the care in, then we have real problems. That's been a particularly difficult problem for Kodiak, and I think that the state needs to step up to that issue and to recognize responsibilities in that area to assist and help communities who can't go it alone. I think certainly in looking at many of the other issues, I think the task force that has worked on the Comprehensive Health Payment and Reform Act has put together a lot of good recommendations. I certainly support most of those recommendations. I think there's some pain in there for all of us. I also think that there's some good things, and I think that it serves as a good vehicle for the debate, and I think that the debate needs to take place. After listening to the opening report, it was very difficult to figure out some of the good things that were happening in healthcare, because there are so many negative things which are happening. But clearly, we do have some advantages and some good things within our system. We certainly have access to technology. I think the quality of care that's being delivered in the institutions has improved dramatically. in recent years, and I think that we still provide people a choice, and certainly in most of the community hospitals, we provide services to everybody who enters our doors. But clearly, the other issue that has to be addressed for hospitals, in my opinion, is what to do with the uninsured, and that is causing a big burden. It's a big burden to our hospital, and with the migrant populations that we experience in Kodiak, it's growing at a tremendous rate, and somehow or another, this needs to be addressed.
Yeah, Jerry Nearhead, could you just give me sort of a rough estimate on what would be the percentage of your uncompensated care as contrasted to your total revenues there in your hospital?
I think currently that this year that we estimate that that we're going to have somewhere in not taking into consideration contractual adjustments, which I think is a different issue, but if we look at just uncompensated care alone, that we're probably going to be somewhere in the range of approaching 15% of our gross revenues. And again, that does not include all deductions from revenue. I'm just speaking here of uncompensated care, charity care, Hill-Burton requirements, and that type of care.
Okay, thank you. And could you shed a little bit, or enlighten me a little bit on where you folks are with your own hospital there and with the expansion plans there for some additional facilities, I think maybe at the Coast Guard base or whatever it is. I understand to some degree you share in those facilities now. What would be the long-range outlook from your standpoint on what would work best out there?
Well, I think that we have some studies ongoing now, and I think that we have taken the position that I think if we wait for the state to solve the problem, it probably isn't going to be solved, and we are moving forward with plans to do something. We don't know whether that something will be to renovate and expand the current facilities or whether to build a new facility. Or which option will be the best. We have studies which are going on at the present time, which hopefully will give us some of those answers. But I also have to say that the full program is beyond the borough's full capability, I believe. And so we're still working closely with the governor's office in hopes that we will see some funding, some matching funding at least, in next year's capital budget. As regards the Coast Guard facilities, we do work very closely with the Coast Guard. We do not utilize any of their facilities. However, recently we've had several meetings, and I believe that we are going to begin sharing some services and developing some other programs, which I think will be mutually beneficial to both of us. As you know, some years ago, the Coast Guard facility built a new facility with the idea that it would be a hospital, but those plans were scrapped when it was, at that time, when it was felt that the borough was, or the state was going to provide funding for a new hospital, so they decided not to finish that facility as a hospital, so basically it's an outpatient clinic.
Yeah, thank you, Ed. I understand. Mike, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I did, Ed. I think that there's a reasonable chance that the state would help match funding from Kodiak. The problem, of course, with new hospital construction around the state is that the state can no longer afford to either build or fund hospitals in every community that wants one. Now, Kodiak has some unique circumstances because it's a regional hub for a hospital for the chain in the areas around Kodiak Island, which ought to add some justification for the hospital there. I'll also say that the funding for the hospital likely will be a part of district allocations for funding, and that's up to your legislators to help participate in that. And when it comes in as a request from the borough to the state as part of district allocations rather than a separate funding out of a statewide portion. And the local effort is important because the state also has to pick up, when we fund beds, costs of operating those beds. And as you know, and everyone else around the state, the focus has been and the pressure has been on reductions in the budget, not new increases. And I recognize that Kodiak is a replacement and not a new facility.
Yes, and I agree, and we certainly are coming to the table, I think, in this regard in a what I believe will be in a major way in the programs that we're developing now, and I think that we understand that this is going to have to be a joint effort.
Yeah, thank you. Just Jerry Neer again. One of the things that we've really looked at the task force level is the wide array of different provider groups up here administering health care to, for example, the Alaska Natives and the Veterans Administration and the Air Force and the Army, and then we have, of course, our private sector and Medicare and Medicaid. The list goes on, and it seems like everybody is promoting their own agenda in a competition mechanism, which is all ultimately, in large portion, funded by the taxpayer. And it would just seem to me that if we could get some mechanism in place that could be the administrative function to handle all those different programs, that there's got to be a considerable savings there. But right now, we've got everybody going their own direction and promoting their own agendas. The ultimate cost there is, I'm sure, is substantial. And getting back to your plight there in Kodiak, that is shared by a lot of other areas out there. And the problem, as you're well aware, is to what degree do you develop a care facility out there, what kind of things can it handle? Because not only do you need to equip it, but you always have the problem of staffing. And as people come and go, and some of the jobs in some of these hospitals are really quite specific. And I even know here in Soldotna that we have around 200 employees, and there's about a 5 or 6 employee turnover every month, and they need to find somebody new to fill those slots. And we're a reasonable sized community for Alaska, and I can just imagine what kind of a problem it might be in some of the areas that don't have the population base that we do.
Yes, I would like to make a comment on a couple of those areas. You're certainly right in that regard. We often are quite fortunate here with our Coast Guard personnel. This year, for example, we probably had, for the first time, we had more applicants for jobs, I think, than we had jobs, because it just so happened this year in the turnover we had a lot of medical personnel dependents that came in. That certainly is not true every year, but you're right, it's pretty difficult. We're much more isolated here in Kodiak. It is a little more difficult to recruit. It also means that we often have to provide services that we normally don't always see in facilities of this size, just simply because of our inability to be able to sometimes get patients off of the island because there is no air traffic moving because of weather. With regard to the sharing of and looking at everybody who is either involved in the provider arena, I have to say that we have been fortunate here in Kodiak. We have been able to reach a contractual agreement in the joint provision of services with our Kodiak Area Native Association, which does have a clinic here. I agree with you. I think it's an issue that if we are going to look at the overall health care structure in this country, that we have to look at all facilities, and we cannot continue to look at facilities in isolation. That is, a VA facility, a military facility, a Indian service facility, and a community facility. We cannot continue to look at those in isolation, and we need to have more planning on the utilization of those beds and bringing those parties together to see where we can get the most effective utilization. And I think I certainly agree with that.
Yeah, thanks for your comments on that, Ed. I've got a note here that we've got Anna standing by in Dillingham. Is anyone there, Anna?
Gary, she may not have dialed in. She might be just waiting by the computer.
I see.
Until somebody shows.
Okay, on Alaska, are you online out there? Do you have any comments or ideas that we might share with you?
We've got three people out here in Alaska. We're members of a newly commissioned Health and Human Services Board, so we're trying to sit in and see what's been what's been done. We've gotten a little bit of reading material and certainly can appreciate what problems Kodiak faces. Ours are even more unique as a regional hub for the Eastern Aleutian chain.
Yes. Who am I speaking to there, please?
Amy Kandowski.
Amy. We would welcome any comments from any other folks that are there with you this evening. And we just sort of have an informal forum going here with Ed Meyer and Kodiak, and Anna's standing by in Dillingham. And so right now the lines are open. So if there are any other comments out there that you'd like to share with us, I'd sure like to hear that, because this effort is, from the extent and the totality that represents Alaska, has been pretty much focused in and around the major population centers. And I, for one, don't have an adequate understanding and appreciation for what the things are that you folks have to deal with, what I call the, not the outback, but you're quite a ways from the beaten trail in this state. And that doesn't mean you have to be very far out of town to be that. But anything that you have in the way of comments, I appreciate hearing from you. Mike Navarre has just left here for a half an hour to attend the Labor Council meeting. Mike is a legislator in the House of Representatives, and of course, as an election year, these guys are on the run for this two-month stretch. And so I'll be just sort of covering the mic here for anybody that cares to respond to this issue.
Yeah, I think there might be a comment coming from on Alaska.
Alaska, you're on the line, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Mike Barber. I'm with the health board here too. I've got some personal things that I've went through in my own medical experiences this year. And I guess probably what I'd like to see is some way of investigating all the overcharging that's being done by the medical profession right now. Well, to me, I just got a new insurance coverage last summer, and I made a couple flights into Anchorage to see if they could find out what was wrong with me. And I came back after going to three different specialists. One turned me over to another. None of them figured out what it was that was wrong with me. And the insurance company wouldn't pay the bill, so I ended up paying the bills plus the insurance. And at one point, I had to take a second CAT scan because somebody stuck a fingerprint on the x-ray of my chest. And to me, the second CAT scan was so unnecessary, and I ended up paying $800 for it.
Yeah, some of those insurance policies normally pay the one way for necessary care to the nearest facility that's equipped to handle that. This was non-emergent type care?
Well, at the time, I thought it was pretty much emergency.
Yeah.
Hardly moved.
Well, you know, I have an insurance background. I've been in it some 25 years, and most policies have a list of exclusions, and when they deny a claim such as that, they will usually give the reason. And
they said it was something prior to the start of the policy that was wrong with me.
Well, pre-existing condition?
Right.
Were they right or wrong?
I was.
Were they right or wrong on that?
Well, I really couldn't tell you other than the fact that I would only guess myself that the majority of it was arthritis at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really can't respond. I hear those types of complaints. I guess I just have to apologize for that. What company and the policies do you have, do you know?
That was the National Association of Self-Employed.
Yeah, I'm not even familiar with that one.
They're out of Texas. They came into Onalaska and sold a lot of self-employed people's homes.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that with complaints as far as what they do cover, but they don't seem to pay anything.
Well, of course, you know that insurance, by its very nature, is designed to avoid claims. And that's...
I just hate to have to pay on both ends, you know. I've where one specialist just keeps passing to another specialist, there comes a time when you got to say that's too much, you know, and I think that there could be somebody to investigate overcharging claims.
Well, in response to the bill you're getting from the doctor's office, and also I might relate this to Ed Meyer in his hospital. Let me just relate this to Ed Meyer in his hospital, because he has indicated that they end up with a shortfall or the cost of non-compensated care of about 15% of his total revenues. And what that would mean to you, or maybe some other people outwardly, might say, well, my bill to cover that is going to have to be 15% more than it would normally be. But let me share this with you. It's a little more involved than that, because that 15% cannot be just passed off to all the other users. For example, they just can't tack it on to Medicare and Medicaid payments, because those people have already determined how much they're going to pay, and you're not going to raise the amount that you can extract from them. And then you can't pass that on to the uninsured and the ones that are using uncompensated care, because they didn't pay in the first place. And the insurance companies sometimes you're not going to raise what they pay, because they already paid their policy limits. So as you sift through that equation, you find out that that 15% is usually picked up by about half of the hospital users. And so instead of their bills being 15% higher, it effectively is around 30% higher. And that's the mechanism of this cost shift. Incidentally, at the Soldotna Hospital, we are somewhat higher than that. I think Mike Lockwood indicated it was, for a while, they're close to 25%. So how that equates in our hospital here is, for the people that use the hospital, other than those others that I mentioned, their bill is about twice, or has a 50% increase, or what it would normally be to cover those additional costs of those that don't pay. And the same kind of mechanism is at play in a physician's office, although not quite to the extent that it would be in the hospitals, because the physicians are not mandated by law to accept everybody, whereby the hospitals are. And so that's why sometimes the hospitals really get whipsawed on this. Any other comments out there from Unalaska, or maybe Dillingham? Kind of quiet there in Kodiak, Ed?
No, I was just thinking about what the gentleman from Unalaska just said, and I'd like to make a couple comments with regard to that. I don't know his particular situation, obviously, but he did bring up an interesting thing, which we just discussed today, and that was the cost of defensive medicine, and that sometimes physicians are placed in a position today of practicing defensive medicine by referring the problem to someone else. Not too long ago, I talked to a family practitioner, for example, that was talking about years ago the fact that if a mother brought a child into his office and had a foreign body in the eye, that often he would examine the child, remove the foreign body. But he says today he's put near caught in a real problem, that if he doesn't refer that child to the ophthalmologist, that he's hung out real bad from a liability standpoint. So many things that he used to do as a family practitioner, he's no longer doing because of that particular issue. And I think that's one of the problems that we have in the system. We currently have a surgeon with us, a locum tenens surgeon, and I had a discussion with her today, and she has been working recently down in Australia, and it was kind of interesting, and I can't remember the city, whether it was Perth or just which city, but she was commenting that in that entire community and several hospitals, there's only one CT scanner, and they seem to do just fine with that. When we look today in our particular system, we have a CT scanner here in Kodiak. You don't find a lot of communities our size with CT scanners, but it's become what we have recognized as necessary in order to defend ourselves in certain situations, in certain medical diagnoses, against the liability issues. I'm not saying that there are not real valid uses for CT scanners. They certainly are. But I think that we tend to take a lot of the technology maybe further than we need to, and the result is we end up with the standards that are impacted down to even small communities such as this, and that tends to really add to the cost of medicine.
Yeah, Roger, on that one, Ed, that whole spectrum of defensive medicine and what that really costs us is hard to define, but a lot of physicians, just to protect themselves, run tests and procedures that ordinarily may not be necessarily indicated, but they're better off if they do it than if they did not do it, in the event that there's some bad outcome there, because it comes around in a form of a legal action. And a physician's really vulnerable if he didn't pursue every conceivable type of remedy or solution for the problem that he has in front of him. And I think your illustration of the person sending a child to an ophthalmologist just because of foreign body in the eye reflects that, and that's just additional cost. You have two providers involved in the additional cost that's represented there. I might just share with you a little bit at the state level here that virtually every group that we hear from, and part of this program tonight is our effort to solicit input from everybody in the state there so that they have a chance to give us their ideas in regard to this effort that we're into, to help broaden our base of understanding what really is out there. But every group that's made presentations to us and has made recommendations on some of the things out there that are pushing healthcare costs have made reference to malpractice and tort reform. You know, the tort laws as a method of settling disputes, out of all the methods that we use to settle disputes out there, are one of the poorest ones that we've got. And that's consistent in this country, and also from a report that I've got from Tillinghast and Associates, which is a national and international actuarial firm. It's the same problem all over the world. And so, as we reflect on it back here in Alaska, it just seems that there needs to be a better way to do this. And I believe our task force is going to come out with some type of an alternative method, usually an arbitration route. We currently have an arbitration statute on the books, but it's not used very much. And as it's currently written, there are some shortcomings in it. First of all, it's not very expedient. It does involve a number of people and expert testimony and those kinds of things. And usually the arbitrator likes to be loved by both sides, so they always kind of try to split the pie in the middle. And interestingly enough, we're going to be having an individual that's from Duke University who is a national expert in arbitration at our meetings tomorrow and the next day. And some of the research that he has done indicates that arbitration, in the way it's presently practiced in this country, really doesn't do much better than our current tort system and going through the court and litigation route. So I was a little bit surprised to hear that, so I'm going to be really listening in depth at his presentation tomorrow or the next day. There's a couple other ideas that are out there that I might just mention here, as long as this has been brought up. And in the June issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, there's two issues. And they talk about a thing called the ACEs, or ACE, which stands for the Alternative Compensation Events. And how it's sort of set up is that we sort of look at some of the typical poor outcomes and try to assign some kind of a compensation value for that to compensate anybody that might occur to, and eliminate arbitration and litigation altogether. And it's based on a formula and a few other factors, and what it does is it compensates a patient almost immediately. There are no hassles and short time span, and what is awarded there seems to be fair and reasonable for whatever the outcome has been. But even that in itself may not necessarily save us a lot of money accept that it could maybe stem the threat that drives this mechanism of defensive medicine. And our current workman's compensation laws are kind of geared along this way. But what I like about it is this. Under our current tort laws, out of about 90% of the poor outcomes go uncompensated because the trial lawyers have testified that they won't take a case unless there's some $200,000+ to go after. And so only about 10% or even less of the poor outcomes and the people that might occur to ever get compensated. And so that's really not too fair. One thing about the ACEs or the accelerated compensation events, even though it may not save very much money, at least it seems to be more fair in the broad sense. And so from that standpoint, I think the idea has got some merit, and I've kind of proposed that to a degree to Dr. Rod Wilson. And we are as a body to make recommendations on this tort reform, but we need to do it in a way that doesn't get us sideways with the Bar Association. Now, one of the problems in this whole effort of health care reform, I think it was summed up in about the March issue of The Economist magazine, and it calls healthcare reform, the issue from hell. Because no matter which avenue you pursue, there's always a vested interest that's going to be impugned, and it can be either a roadblock or turn your direction, so sometimes you end up going back in a circle. And so I think, as Mike indicated earlier, that there is not going to be any easy way out of this. And indeed, if we try to trim costs, we need to realize that all those dollars are ending up someplace. And when we try to short-circuit some of those in the interest of expediency and efficiency, somebody's going to be upset about it. And that's one of the things I see, that if we bring this whole spectrum of malpractice outside the court system and handle it by another mechanism, that we're going to have some folks upset there too. So I hope there's some answers out there. But right now, it seems to be a hassle every one that we pursue. Anybody agree or disagree on that one?
Oh, okay. Ed Myers again. I can certainly say that I think about any change would be a change in the right direction. What we have right now is not serving, I agree with you in part, it's certainly not serving all of those who are harmed in the system. On the other hand, it's certainly not serving the system well. It's not serving medicine well. And it's hampering medicine. Small hospitals such as this can't afford the cost. And I'll tell you that in the last 2 to 2.5 years, that this hospital has spent more than $800,000 in attorney fees alone. All of the cases that we have reviewed in the last year or disposed of have been without merit. And it's easy to file a case, but every one of those that we dispose of, we have to go through a long, lengthy legal process in order to get it disposed of. And there's something wrong with that. We're the deep pocket. We continue to be the deep pocket under the current system. We have had a case in which clearly our hospital was the deep pocket when they decided not to go after anyone but us because we had the insurance. And I think it clearly was not our case, but we had to defend that case. So it's a real problem. I do believe that we need to have tort reform. I think if we don't have it, we're going to lose services in the state. We know that if we don't do something about obstetrics, we're not going to have any physicians in the state willing to deliver babies. Malpractice insurance for an obstetrician, I was told today, ranges up to about $88,000 for a family practitioner. If he's active in delivering babies and delivers 30 or more a year, his malpractice will be over $36,000. So, and if you take that and into a community like this, we could certainly use an obstetrician here, but if I just took the malpractice cost alone and assumed that he delivered every baby on the island, it would be a terrific cost to those people who are having the babies, and I just believe something needs to be done.
Well, I concur on that, and I also concur on your numbers. Not only the OBGYN guys, but anesthesiologists, and I guess neurosurgeons, and I guess orthopedic surgeons. Those guys all have premium rates that are up in the $70,000, $90,000 range. And of course, we as consumers need to realize that that has to be reflected in the bills that that you have to pay when you use a hospital or a physician, because that's part of his overhead. As a matter of fact, just as a point of information here, the a private physician's office usually runs somewhere between 60 and 70% overhead that is the portion that that physician has to pay before there's anything in it for himself. And that includes, of course, his office space, his equipment, and his staff, and then the insurance cost that he has to pay, and then the equipment and supplies and all those kinds of things. And but if you're looking at a $70,000 or $80,000 malpractice insurance bill, you know, that pays for a lot of equipment and a lot of staff, but that also has to be added on to his total overhead. So those people, like everyone else in business, need to figure to recover that from the product that they sell. Interestingly enough, there seems to be a new breed of physicians coming down line that have sort of made a determination that they would just rather practice medicine than to operate a business. And some of those physicians are just hiring on at hospitals and enjoy like an 8-to-5 job, and have found that there's a lot more comfort in that, and there's not the hassle or the anxiety of trying to operate their own business. So maybe that's going to be a change we'll see up the line here too. You might have a locum tenens there. I understand as a person that's kind of goes along those lines too. You want to comment on that, Ed?
Yeah, we of course we our locum tenens that we have here now is we have to use a lot of locum tenens with some of our medical staff just in order to give them a break. If these one deep specialties, for example, we have to do that. With regard to your comment, number one, about overhead, I think that's essentially about right. My numbers that I see in the journals are somewhere in the range of 60 to 65% in a typical clinic situation. And I think that with regard to the trend that we're seeing when we're recruiting in practices today is you're right. We see an awful lot of physicians who want to come into a situation where they do not want to hire office staff. They don't want to have to go through the billing. They want to generate their own income. But what they want to do is they want somebody else to do that. And one of the reasons is several physicians have told me, the billing process is so horrendous today that it just isn't worth the hassle. But sometimes if they had to look at just to see whether it was worth it to practice medicine after they looked at the billing process, some of them probably wouldn't have gone to medical school. So a lot of them are looking for situations where they can come in where they don't have those headaches, but that they can make a reasonable living and have a reasonable lifestyle. I think that is very attractive to many of the particularly younger physicians that are coming out today, that are coming out with, in essence, a new set of practice principles that they're looking at.
I'm familiar with that. I've got a couple articles here in front of me that have to do with physician compensation, of course, and I've been buttonholed a couple. But if that does for society, I guess I'm not too much threatened for some physician that does well financially. I think our nation's got its values kind of backwards.
Yeah, I think there certainly are probably those situations out there. I think if we tend to look at the averages, though, I think sometimes we tend to overinflate what we think some do, and I think it runs the full gamut. I think, yes, there are those out there that do real well, but I also know an awful lot of guys that struggle, that like to practice medicine, but when you're looking at 60 and 65% overhead, if you stop and translate that to how much revenue you have to generate out of your own services and delivering care to patients, that takes a lot of money to do it, and the end result is not all. I think we all know that family practitioners historically have probably been underpaid. Probably a lot of the specialists, at least the government feels that they've been overpaid, and the RBRVS system was supposed to have reversed some of that. I don't think it did, but nevertheless, I think that by and large, if we look at the averages I think that they're not all quite that high. I think it's reasonable to expect to make a reasonably good living, but I think that we tend to focus a lot of times and focus in a negative way on those few situations where there are a lot of dollars. That tends to kind of hurt the whole medical profession.
Yeah, and I agree, and that's just an example that was posed to me, but there are other folks that do quite well on occasion here too. You know, we have a pretty decent red fishery here in the Cook Inlet, and there are folks that sometimes gross $1 million in the season, which is probably only like 15 or 20 fish period days. And so from that standpoint, that's not too bad either. Especially when they're harvesting a public resource. Are there any other comments out there from Unalaska or Dillingham? Anna, did somebody show up in Dillingham yet?
This is Amy out in Unalaska, and perhaps I could ask you, how do you see the rural Alaskans and real isolated people, how can we be folded into this task force and their recommendations for reform? You know, we live in a community that is extremely isolated. We have a nonprofit clinic that's operated out here. It's a primary health care facility, but we certainly aren't a hospital. We don't have any physicians on the island. All of our the medical treatment that's required in that fashion either has to be done by itinerant physicians out here, or people are flown or medevaced into Anchorage. So I'm just a little curious, from a rural resident's point of view, how some of your recommendations, what feedback you've gotten from other rural communities that don't have hospital facilities and, you know, are very isolated, how your recommendations might benefit those of us.
Yeah, Amy, I don't really have a good answer for you. This effort of going on a conference call like this is our attempt to solicit information from you folks out there so that we have at least a better understanding of some of the things that are of concern to you. As long as I've got you on the line here, could you share with me a little bit on the very nature of your clinic? Who owns the building? Who pays for the staffing? What types of things you're able to do there, and that kind of information, because we're also trying to find a broader understanding of what really is out there, because I'm probably like most any other layperson that has been charged with this effort, and I can only be effective based on what I can find out and in the way of problems that lie out there.
Well, I could. I'll do my best to attempt to describe it. We run primary care facilities. It was built about 25 years ago to serve a community of 500 people for the communities of Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Nokolsky, and Atka, and also Akutan, which are all islands, very isolated, real limited air service, and no, of course, no road system. It's run by a nonprofit board of directors. We have an administrator, 3 physician's assistants, mid-level practitioners, 4 RNs, and lab tech and x-ray tech people, and then a small support staff in the main office. The majority, because we support in this just a little over 3,000 square foot building that we are currently operating out of, we are responsible for all the health care services for the community of Unalaska, which has now grown to approximately 4,000 people. We're still the primary giver of care for the communities of Nokolsky, Atka, and Akutan. Akutan has just recently installed 1 or I believe maybe 2 major processing plants, so they have got about in excess of 500 people in that village, which is 17 air miles away from us. Nikolsky is a very small village of approximately 40 people. And then we also support the Bering Sea Fishing Fleet. What that means is we are then responsible for maybe up to 30,000 people, and primarily trauma-type injuries with no physicians. We do have itinerant physicians, as I've mentioned in the past, but we have either been unsuccessful in recruiting physicians to come out for many of the reasons you discussed, and also for some other reasons, primarily that it's very difficult for us to afford to pay a physician to come out here. We just, I'm on the board of directors for the Ililit Family Clinic, and we've just completed are about to complete our first year with Lutheran Health Care System. They've provided us with some direction and a little bit of assistance, but you know, we deliver a tremendous amount of health care with very few of the resources that are enjoyed by those larger communities. And we're kind of an anomaly for rural Alaska in that we're dealing with major trauma, enormous amounts of that. So our mid-levels have to be definitely versed in that type of trauma. Also, I think part of the problem of the community is very resentful that we do not have a medical doctor available out here all the time, and that has really become a problem for us. We have managed to put together a new building which is under construction and we hope will be completed. The state legislature, the governor gave us an appropriation 2 years in a row, a small amount of money, raised the remainder within the community and within the fishing industry. So that's kind of where we're at this point. We're fairly self-sufficient. We can deliver primary health care. I mean, people come to us with all kinds of everything from a cut finger or a kid with a headache or a fever to severe trauma injuries from the fishing fleet. And we are the primary source of health care, the only source of health care for many miles in all directions. So we're in kind of a unique situation here. We don't have a lot of indigent or non-pay type patients. No one is turned away, but we certainly don't have that. That is a problem. So we're a little bit different, but at the same time, very curious about what's going on, what kind of access rural Alaskans, improved access they can have to health care. I think we've been pretty creative out here, but definitely done without any much state support or understanding.
Yeah, well, that's quite enlightening. I was really kind of unaware that you had it pulled together that well out there. We had some folks visit with us from out of Dillingham about a month ago. And I can't remember, is it Kanakanak Hospital or something out there that's sort of south and west of Dillingham? And questioning that individual to find out that a lot of the native corporations around the state are becoming more involved in healthcare on a regional basis, not only for the Alaska Native people, but also for anybody else that might be in that region. But our knowledge of the task force, at least mine, we have a couple folks on there that probably are much more informed on that than myself, but we've had a number of questions about it, and I just have to apologize to you and all the rest of the folks out there that, at least I speak for myself, if not for all the rest of the task force members, that our knowledge is certainly not adequate for the plight that that you folks face way out there. I was surprised that Alaska is 4,000 people. That's a sizable settlement. I also know that the fishing industry is one of the most hazardous occupations that we as a state have. It rivals or exceeds logging. And we both know that we lose a great number of people out there every year. And I can appreciate your comments on trauma, because most all those fishing boats are involved with equipment in some very adverse weather situations, and it's just a lot of risk. And we all know folks that they're gone because of the hazards in that industry. The state has in place a statute or a provision we call a certificate of need. And there are numerous requests for healthcare facilities around this state. But the certificate of need process, although not perfect, is an attempt to make sure that anything that is proposed is not going to compete in a negative aspect for facilities that are already in place, because it's just not efficient. Somebody's market share might be cut in half if we put a facility that does very nearly the same thing within that same market area. So this certificate of need process is one of the things that anybody needs to kind of wade through to get any new facilities in place. And I think there's a dollar limit on it. If whatever you're proposing is less than, let's say, $1 million, that the process is modified or in some cases maybe even eliminated. But that's given us some problem too, because for example, an MRI machine, a new one, is several million bucks anymore if you count the build out for the room and the lead and so forth, and plus the instrument. But there are apparently used units in the marketplace that could be installed and may end up costing less than $1 million. And so the law by itself doesn't preclude that sort of event from occurring, and then you also have then two facilities competing in the same marketplace, maybe to the adversity of both. But there are some ideas on the mill right now to look at that and again, to see where it may need to be improved if it does. But it's fairly typical, I guess, not only in this state, but in a number of others. And of course, the goal is to try not to put a lot of additional facilities in your healthcare system that need to be paid for by the utilizers, especially when you can probably get by with what we've got. Any other comments out there? It's kind of quiet in Dillingham.
Dillingham has gone home, and they request, nobody showed up there, they request that, you know, the CLEAT send their participants reports to them.
Okay. Have we warned you other guys out there in on Alaska yet?
There are four of us here, just listening at this point. One thing I might recommend, I don't know how feasible it is, but for your task force, if you're considering recommendations to the legislature, I really feel that it would be quite an experience if someone from the task force could actually come out and take a look at conditions that we work under and live under and provide our medical services. It really is pretty miraculous. I can't say enough good things about our system out here, even though it isn't very traditional in the sense of a, you know, road access major healthcare facility like Providence or even a community hospital. I think that a lot could be learned, although I realize that our position is, tends to be a little more unique in the bush, but nonetheless, really pretty.
Well, I think your point is well taken. As a matter of fact, that was our first preference to doing this phone patch and teleconference. But we as a group also have a budget limitation, and to fund the people that come statewide into this meeting once a month for 2 days in Anchorage, and to hire an executive secretary to sort of collate all the data and assemble their stuff and be the kind of choreographer for our meetings. The budget that was put together just did not have enough money in that, you know, to comply with the kind of thing that you've recommended here. And I just think it would be really important and useful if we could do that, not only on Alaska, but some of these other places that are out off the, you know, the mainstream of Alaska, in Yukon Delta country and up on the Arctic slope. How far is Unalaska from Kodiak? 500 or 600 miles out there, or is it not quite that far?
Well, it's probably not that far, but the problem is you have to go to Anchorage to get there. So we're 800 air miles from Anchorage, and then you have to backtrack to Kodiak.
Yeah, and I think the edge is only about 250 out of Anchorage, if I'm right on that.
That's correct.
And then you have some other islands out there. Akutan, how far is that out from you?
Akutan is about 17 air miles away on Alaska to the northeast, but it can take up to 12 hours to get there by vessel. And Nikolsky is on the island to the south of us. That's a good hour's flying time.
It is.
Yeah, from on Alaska. And yeah, and we don't have any a regular full-service airport at any of these villages. There is no airport and no airstrip in Akutan. They have to land, they have to take in float planes. Nikolsky and Unalaska here you have to do strictly daylight flying out of here. We only have a 3,000-foot runway.
Mm-hmm. Well, jet traffic goes beyond you out there someplace, Amchitka and Attu.
Yeah, we don't have much connection with those islands with the military.
I see. Well, I think my hat's off to you folks out there. I'm very enlightened on how much, based on your own resources and initiative and determination, to put together, I think, as good a program as you have at least expressed to us, based on what has to be, I would say, rather extreme limitations and obstacles. I'm not sure we even have it put that well together, even with our own Kenai Borough. With 4,000 people, I'm surprised that it is that many there.
Well, and that's only, you know, those are only full year-round residents. We probably are closer to 6,000 or 8,000 people if you consider the itinerant people. We have a lot of migrants. We have, you know, we support international fishing fleets. We were the number one port in the United States for fish landed and for 3 or 4 years in a row now. So we're a very busy international port and support international shipping as well as the U.S., the domestic fishing fleet, the Bering Sea. So we're very busy out here. And I think perhaps if you hear an edge to my voice, it's simply because Unalaska and the resources that come from this region, certainly we don't own them exclusively, but we put so much back into the state coffers and see so very, very little in the presence of state troopers. We have no DFYS worker out here. You know, it goes on and on and on. And even though we begged and borrowed and lobbied for several years in a row to get financial support to build our new facility, and we did get some, but it certainly was not a very large amount. And we have to be resourceful. We do give a great deal to the state in the form of revenue and are given very little back. In fact, we're really represented in a substandard fashion, I would say. So that's why, we hear this all the time. We wish we could come out. We wish we could get some input. Yes, you need a new clinic, or yes, you need better health care, but nobody actually bothers to see for themselves. And that's what's frustrating for us, because we're forced to do it on our own. And maybe, you know, there can be some good lessons learned by that. You know, it's a forced isolation, and it is a forced cooperation, and people can actually do that, but we realize that we're very limited as well. We have to send our patients. If a woman has a tubal pregnancy, none of that can be dealt with out here locally. She must be flown to Anchorage and then go through that process. So for us, health care, and for the insurers as well, it's a very expensive proposition out here. And yet we're competitively priced. Our clinic does not overcharge for office visits. In many ways, we undercharge. So it's pretty remarkable, and I'm just curious to see if perhaps this might not be a national trend going toward away from community hospitals and more towards, you know, direct primary care facilities like ours. It's real interesting to see this whole scenario played out.
Well, I can comment on a couple of places, Amy. One is a national trend tends to show that a lot of the small rural hospitals tend to be closing. But that's because that care is accessible by other means, but that's certainly not the case out there where you folks are. But there's a couple things that you brought up, and also I might like to have Ed respond to this, that at least it's, your comment surprised me, that you have a rather substantial transient workforce that comes in on a seasonal basis, and you provide care for those people, but you've also indicated that very little of that is uncompensated care. So apparently all those folks must have some means of paying for that care. And I would just wonder if that's maybe the same for you in Kodiak yet, because it does not appear to be that way here in the Kenai Borough, because a lot of the transient cannon workers come in and they have really no means to pay for health care, so they're just part of that uncompensated care burden that we have here each summer.
Yes, that's the same, I think, basically in Kodiak. Canneries here bring in a large, we see a big growth in our Hispanic population here recently, and they do not have insurance, and we continue to see growth in that particular area. I think in Unalaska, more of it comes, or less of it comes, because there are insurers down there. Vessels, I'm not sure, that service the area, whether they do or not. I might add that we are just beginning bringing online our marine health program, which will be one of only two or three of the hospital-based programs in the United States to link vessels to our emergency room physicians on a 24-hour basis, and to try to improve care in that particular segment of the industry by giving quicker access to medical advice in those instances. So I think generally our experience is probably very similar to Soldatna's experience, but not as, probably less similar to that in Unalaska.
Another comment, Amy, on revenues. There was a study conducted by Scott Goldsmith with the University of Alaska. He is an economist there. And these numbers are, I think, for either year 1989 or 90, that it talks about the total revenue that the state of Alaska receives from its fisheries. It didn't really define what those sources were, but I imagine that's probably license fees and taxes and maybe a few other things. But the number was somewhere around 52,000 or thereabouts, maybe 56,000. That's total Alaska state revenue from our fisheries. And yet, the state of Alaska spends on its fisheries some amount in excess of $90 million. And so the fisheries in this state are subsidized substantially. And it would seem to me that Alaska is cited in probably one of the most lucrative fisheries that exist in the world. How come they can't make it balance out better than that? Because we were looking at that as a possible funding source to take care of some of the needs that are out there, such as you have expressed. But unless we can get a fishery that can at least break even, we're just not doing very well, I don't think.
Now, Jerry, it would be real interesting if you know how we could get a hold of that report. That's very different from what we experienced. None of us are economists, but we all live here and deal with the that is definitely not the case. Very big time business. We've got three major processing plants in this town that could be disassembled tomorrow if the bottom fish industry ceases. They're spending, you know, $6, $8, $10 million to put up these plants. More than that. And you know, they could be taken down tomorrow, and they're designed just for that purpose. History does go good. They can move on to other places.
A collapsible corporation under Section 243. those numbers, I don't have them here with me, but I do have them in a briefcase that's at my house. And the reason I kept the information was that I know the source, and it just was rather, it struck me as being rather strange. I do have some data here in Alaska. One is that you have a sales tax there of some $7.5 million every year, and that you have a raw fish tax at 2.5% that is in excess of $2.5 million. Does that come to your community, or does that go to the state? The 2.5% fish tax, that maybe goes to the state, huh?
No, as far as I understand it, I'm a state employee and not, you know, I don't work in the fishing industry directly. So unfortunately, some of the other people that represent the clinic board aren't here tonight that do work for the industry, so they could address that more directly. But our sales tax is city-generated, and it is 3%. And our fish tax does go to the city. So I do know, and I don't know what portion of that does go to the state. I believe there is a tonnage tax that does go to the state, but what it is, I'm not sure of.
We have a, I think it's a 3% fish tax here in the Kenai Borough, but that is paid by the processor, but that is paid to the state. And there is a formula whereby those monies are reallocated by the state back out to the communities that are impacted by the fish industry. But I haven't been able to track just exactly how that comes back and where it goes. But this report that I mentioned by Scott Goldsmith is ISER. What does it stand for? The Institute of Social Economic Research. And I'm not sure I got the updated one, but that's the agency that did the study on the impact of the fisheries in Alaska, not only from the standpoint of the revenue that we received, but also it dealt a little bit in the ownership percentages of the fishery and the tonnages landed at different places and by species also, and also the dollar amounts of those various tonnages that are landed in, either the wholesale or retail values. And the total value of the fishery, of course, is enormous, but what impressed me about the article is how much of it leaves here and how little of it stays.
That's very true, Jerry. Everybody's kind of going, yeah, that's right. A good majority of the major companies are either international companies in the case of the onshore, the shore-based processors, or Seattle-based companies that come up here and fish, partake in the bottom fish industry or the crabbers, and they do take the majority of that money, and many of our transient workers who are here, say, 6 months out of the year, do live elsewhere and aren't registered to vote, don't participate in the community, but do put an enormous strain upon an infrastructure that's really designed for a community of between 500 and 1,500 people. So it's always a balancing act. And because the fisheries have been real cyclical in the way they produce, it's hard to be able to project for growth, to plan for growth. It happens at every level. It's been very difficult with the clinic. It's been extremely difficult with the school. The same thing. We just had a new $11 million school. The day the doors were open, it was outgrown. We're already looking at for about a 6 to 8 classroom number of children. And it's real hard to plan down line. We don't have unemployment. Isn't a problem here. So indigent or those kinds of people who can't pay their medical expenses are pretty rare out there. I would say, I believe that our ISHS clinic probably has about 5% of all the money that comes into the clinic or that bills to the clinic would be actually stuff we couldn't collect.
I suspect possibly because it's reasonably expensive to get there, unless you come up already employed on a boat, that maybe you're impact with transient seasonal workers that are not well financed is probably minimal. I suspect probably that's even true in Kodiak. Here in the Anchorage, Kenai, Soldotna, Seward area, and Valdez, and maybe even Cordova, a lot of these folks can just kind of hitchhike up the highway and camp out in the tent for the summer, and that's another situation here. But Mike Navarro has just returned here, Ed and Amy, and if you have any specific comments, he is a legislator, and maybe he can address some of these issues in more depth than myself.
Yeah, I didn't hear all of them, but I know one of the questions was why doesn't Alaska get more help from the state? And I know that there's been a request in, and we funded it actually this year, I believe, for the health clinic this year or last year, for part of the cost of that. The reason that we only fund part of it is because the state, regardless of where the impacts are, the state can't afford to fund what every community in the state wants any longer. And in the Kenai Peninsula Borough, for example, we bonded for and built our hospital. It wasn't the state who paid for it. And that's what has to happen, I think, more into the future, is that we're going to be looking at communities to support and pay for more of the facilities that they need in their communities, because the state revenues are going down, and all of the focus and pressure on the budget is to reduce the budget, not increase the budget. And I think that in addition to the 2% raw fish tax that you have, which is a special tax, the state's raw fish tax is shared back at 50% to the local municipality. Are there any other specific questions I could answer, or some that I missed that you'd like to ask again?
No, I don't see any out here in Unalaska. I would just like to clarify, perhaps you didn't hear everything that I had to say. Our clinic, the legislature was approached twice for funding, or three times, I guess 3 years in a row. And we did receive some money 2 years, this year and the year before, but the majority of that money did not come from the state, nor was it requested from the state. That money was generated locally and through the industry through pledges and challenge grants and that kind of thing. And I don't think it's ever really been the intent of our local clinic, which serves maybe upwards to between 30 and 60,000 individuals in a 3,000 square foot facility, and has done it pretty well without a medical doctor on staff, except for itinerant physicians. I don't think it was ever our intention for the state to fund, but to recognize how important the service that is provided out here is, how isolated we actually are, and the amount of trauma injuries that we deal with out here because of the industry primarily. But I don't think it was ever the intention. I know it was never the intention that it looked as if Unalaska or the clinic was expecting the state to put the whole bill. I don't think that was ever the intent.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Jerry Neer again. Any other comments out there from your group, Amy or Ed, you guys in Kodiak? Anything you want to hear from us?
We do have an individual here that would like to make a few comments, so let me get him over here to the mic.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, my name is Harry Felton. I'm a physician's assistant, and I'm in private practice here in Kodiak. Reading through some of the recommendations, kind of outlined, clearly it has an economic incentive in trying to reform healthcare funding and systems. Listening to the folks in Dutch and Unalaska, thinking about our problems here in Kodiak, one of the fundamental issues is health manpower. Even if we have funding systems, we don't have adequate levels of healthcare providers in Alaska. It's a problem nationwide. Rural healthcare in the lower 48 has great difficulty recruiting and retaining healthcare providers, and we multiply that factor, looking for another physician to join our group, looking for ER physicians, we're losing our surgeon and trying to recruit. Part of the access mandate of this really has, I think, a lot to do with recruitment and retention, and what can the state's role be in assisting with that through its facilities.
Yeah, that's a good one. There is a physician in Palmer, I believe her name is Dr. Doty, and what they're trying to set up, and it's sort of a given that a physician generally practices within a close proximity to where they, you know, performed a residency. And so some of the thoughts were that Alaska is a great rural healthcare training arena, and that possibly we could get some efforts out of this WAMI program to bring some of these people in here for their residencies and maybe internships, and maybe as sort of a training ground for some of these people, because there is, I don't think, any better arena for rural healthcare than what we have that we can present here in Alaska.
speaking from the standpoint of the Kenai Borough, that we have a community called Seward that has sort of a chronic problem of physician recruitment and retention. And that's, I think, part of the focus that we need to address here in the long term, are what kind of mechanisms can we put in place that would help solve that, or at least encourage the solution to that particular problem. And I just don't have any answers to it. And I've read some things by Dr. Wood out of Petersburg on the problems of retaining physicians in Alaska because of some of the basic amenities that a physician would like to have, not only for himself, but also for his family. And not always are those kind of needs or desires available in rural Alaska. So it takes a really special type of individual to adapt into some of those environments. And there may not be that many around, so I can concur it is a problem. And maybe you see that a little bit in Kodiak, you're going to be losing your surgeon. I think here in the Kenai-Soldaten area that we've been relatively blessed, but I know that's not a uniform situation throughout the state. I know they run into it not only in your area, but in a lot of other areas.
You're raising the WAMI program is an interesting issue, and I'm not sure how much the state of Alaska and its participation in WAMI is paying per year. There are hundreds of thousands of dollars. The actual retention of those medical students returning to Alaska is relatively low. And I think the question of a family practice residency, practitioner and physician assistant programs, both nurse practitioners and physician's assistants play a major role in bush healthcare, much like what the folks in Dutch and in Alaska described. And I think motivations, there are some very interesting creative systems. Oregon at one time had a system where the State Board of Licensing would have high-need counties and low-need counties and try and motivate by licensing folks going into areas of need and not giving licenses in the Portland area and giving licenses for rural areas. And I'm not sure if that continued, but that was a creative idea in terms of supply and demand.
Yeah, there are a number of different mechanisms that have been put in place out there. Another one that's been brought by our group was to help finance medical school for some of these people with a provision that they would come back and practice in rural Alaska for some period of time to offset that cost. And that's not something that we have just developed here within our group. That's been tried and utilized in a number of different areas. So far, I don't think there's a program like that in place up here at this point. Your other comment was something that I reflected on earlier. To put in a substantial facility, out in the bush as we call it, run into the item that you've expressed, and that's a staffing problem. Because the better your facility, the more specific are the job performances that have to be in that structure. And a lot of times those types of skills are not uniformly available in a small community. I mentioned to Ed and some of the other folks that were online earlier. We experience that same kind of problem even here in Soldotna. And we're really a small hospital, but by Alaska standards, we're fairly reasonable. But they have a staff of 200, and they have a turnover of 5 or 6 employees a month, which means they have to find somebody to replace that specific type of job, but it's not always that easy. So I can just relate that that would be really a problem out in the bush, where you have a facility that's well-equipped, but cannot find adequate technicians to make it work, at least on an ongoing basis. Any other comments out there? How about you folks at Dillingham? Been kind of quiet over there. They're all gone home on Alaska. You folks have any more comments? Or we about wore you out here tonight. Tell me what you might like to see us develop at the state level here in this task force. We have got a lot of ideas in front of us. We are to sunset here as a group in February with the recommendations as best that we're able to identify and put on paper. and to present those to the legislature. And hopefully someone there, or at least a group of those folks, can craft some kind of plan out of this that might be workable. I think the magnitude is, at least to the extent that I've been involved, is substantially greater than I thought it was going to be, and not to throw rocks at anybody, but I think we're going to be indeed fortunate if we can put together something that somebody else can deal with that will give us the answer to this, you know, by February, at least by the end of this legislative session. But I don't feel so badly about that, because there is nobody in the country that's, at least in my mind, any further along at solving this than we are ourselves. There are a number of states that are putting in place some ideas. They're in a phase-in. We can see at the federal level that nobody there is consolidated on a direction to go. So I guess this thing is a ponderable for everybody. You know, at the last year's governor's conference, that the governor's recommendation and a consensus was that this is something that each state should address on its own and use its own resources and talent to solve it. You're all aware, of course, that Hawaii pioneered this type of effort some 16 or 17 years ago. It's pointed out as an example of what a state can do if it decides it's going to do something about it. That program has got some real merits going for it. To superimpose that on Alaska at least gives me some problems. I'm not sure it would fit here very well. Mainly based on the circumstance that our economic bases are very much different. And that community, or that state of Hawaii, is sort of way out there by itself, and so they're almost like a self-contained unit, and so it would seem to make a lot of sense for them to develop internally their own healthcare system. Sort of kind of what you guys have done out on Alaska. You don't have outside resources available very readily, so you've had to look within to solve the problem. And I think to some regard, I think that's the plight that we in Alaska are going to find ourselves on a statewide basis.